And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. So it turns out that we recently discussed the virtues of building electrification, which is the concept that the place you live, it would be good to have it run completely on electricity and essentially take natural gas, which most homes in Massachusetts use, get that out of the equation. Have your home run on electricity. And there are, we had a good discussion about the fact that it's practical, technologically available, all good things can be done. It just requires some will to do it. So I refer you to the podcast. We'll put up a link to that podcast in the show notes for this show, and you can go back and take a listen. But we are we can see out in the future that there are some practical barriers, reasons why people may not want to quickly change their home over to fully electric. And in order to discuss some of the reasons that the building electrification movement, how the building electrification movement could move a little faster, we are thrilled to be joined by Bryn Fury, who is with Environment America and has recently written a report on building electrification, a national report after surveying the entire country about what are the good things about building electrification. How are you doing, Bryn? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ted. I'm doing great today.
That's great. That's great. Great. So tell me if I got the story wrong, but what I'd like to hear from you is what are the barriers that basically slow your average homeowner, people listening to this podcast, what makes it a little bit scary for them to think about electrifying their home?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there are three main barriers that I would point to. The first one being just a simple lack of knowledge, not knowing that electric technologies are available and what the benefits of adopting those technologies are. And that lack of knowledge could be for the homeowner. It could also be for the contractor and the builders. They might also not be super familiar with the benefits of electric technology. And as a result, that, you know, heat pumps and things like that just fall to the wayside. Another that I would point to would be cost effectiveness. When we're talking about retrofits and making a building that currently runs on fossil fuels into one that runs off of electricity, it sometimes is cost effective and makes financial sense to retrofit, but a lot of times it isn't. And that's where we need things like cost incentives and rebate programs to make it easier for folks. Mm-hmm. And the last barrier that I'll point to is that fossil fuel systems last a really long time. So if we are looking at a new gas furnace and other fossil fuel powered appliances that are installed today, those things might last for 15 years, and it won't make sense to replace them and adopt something new for another 15 years. And so those are, I think, are some of the three main things that are slowing the transition to electrifying our buildings.
Right. And I think those are accurate points, because most people are pretty conservative, right? They don't want to do something that affects their everyday life if they're not confident that it's going to be better. I guess, wasn't it Machiavelli who wrote about how, you know, it's only the people who benefit oftentimes don't know that they're going to benefit. So they don't really, mm-hmm. people don't understand that with these very practical technologies, and we're talking about like induction stoves in the kitchen, heat pumps, which are essentially reverse air conditioning systems to heat your home. These are all things that can be pretty practically done, right? That those things are not so scary. And as you say, if the contractor says, well, you know, I never put in a heat pump before, everyone just throws up their hands and says, okay, give me a gas heater. And then we're stuck for 15 years with another gas heater.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think if you're a homeowner, you want to have that confidence that this is, if you're making a change in your technology, that it's going to be something that's efficient, something that works for you. When we're talking about things as important as what heats your home and what gives you hot water and like hot coffee in the morning, you want to know that those systems are going to work. And if your gas furnace works fine for you and you don't know that there's great benefits of installing an electric technology, you're going to just stick with the gas furnace, right? So you want to have confidence that if you're going to make that switch and take that risk, that it's going to be a solid one and a good one and one that benefits you environmentally, you know, health-wise and financially.
And so that's where the sort of the task of the climate hawk is to make sure that knowledge gets out there, right? And exactly. So that people are aware, they're familiar, that they, when someone says ground, you know, says heat pump, everyone smiles, yeah, I know what a heat pump is, and, you know, no problem. And mm-hmm. the other task of the climate hawk is to be pushing for the sort of financial incentives to help people pay for these changes, right? So that, because as you said, every day a new gas heater goes in, like here we are in May of 2021, we're committing to gas heating through 2036, right? A 15-year lifetime for that. So getting on this relatively soon to stop this continuous pushing the infrastructure out 15 years is an important thing. So there's work to be done, right? Even here in Massachusetts, where we like to pat ourselves on the back, but there's a lot of work left to be done, right?
There is a lot of work to be done.
So I guess the other, those are what I would call sort of passive obstacles, things that can be addressed through education and political work, right? Are there any other kinds of things that are blocking the transition to a building electrification?
Yes. As you can imagine, the gas industry sees an existential threat in electric technologies and in repowering with 100% renewable energy because folks will no longer be paying for their gas. And so national campaign to rally against electrification. So in, I think, over 20 states now, there are anti-electrification preemption bills. And what these bills do is they take away the power of communities to go all electric and they preempt it to the state. This is a problem.
Oh. No, my eyebrows are like halfway up back into my head. You're saying that in 20 U.S. states, the gas industry, that is to say natural gas, purveyors of natural gas, are actively trying to make laws to prevent the use, to prevent, what do you say, local ordinances and local building codes? That really, that's astounding.
Bingo, right? Bingo. Yes.
I mean,
yes,
that's not something that should just, I mean, preemption bill is, sounds abstract, but what they mean is they don't want you to have electric anything, right? They want you to be locked in like a, okay, keep going. Yes. I'll try and get my eyebrows back off my, off my forehead.
Mm-hmm. If you, so the progress that we're seeing on electrification is coming at the local level right now. So over 40 cities and counties in California have made some move to restrict gas use in new buildings. We've seen Seattle make a similar commitment, New York City. So these are happening at the local level, and the gas industry is spooked by that. And so they are lashing out, and they are trying to basically prevent that from happening in places where it hasn't happened yet. And so that's what the point of these preemption bills is. It's to take away that local power and make it harder by preempting it to the state. And so you can think of it like they're trying to pass a ban on possible gas bans. Mm-hmm. So it's just very defensive in that way.
It's sort of, you can imagine, just as an example, not that this is the case, but like Texas, the state government would not like electrification, but the city of Austin, which I understand is a blue little patch of blue in a relatively red state, they might want to pass a local ordinance that says you can ban gas hookups. But then the state comes in and says, no, Austin, you can't. Really, that's the kind of strategy, right? To have the more conservative state government control things.
Exactly. And there actually is a bill in Texas. It's HB 17, and it's currently still active. And so that exact scenario that you just described, it could happen. There could be communities that really want to transition to 100% clean energy and electrify their buildings for their health, for the health of their community. And they simply will not have the option because of these bills.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So this is happening. So this is an organized effort because the gas industry is national, right? It's like they're all talking to each other. I'm sure there's a Zoom call going on somewhere right now between the American Petroleum Association figuring out how to do this, right? They see their existential is the right word. I mean, they just evaporate, so to speak, if no one's using gas anymore, the whole industry goes away, right? So they're ready to fight back.
Yes. Yeah. And the American Gas Association is actually found to be using ratepayer money to pay for these lobbying efforts, which, you know, really just adds a whole new layer to it. And yeah, I mean, it makes sense, but it's really disheartening to see. And these bills are moving really quickly. And we're expecting more next legislative session as well. So it's, you know, we're not anywhere near the end of the fight. We've seen a lot of these, I think, I don't want to say the wrong number, but we've seen them pass, I think, in at least 12 states.
Already.
It was 4 states as of the beginning of 2021, and it's already just, you know, they've been passing left and right all over the country. They keep popping up like, you know, it's like whack-a-mole, basically.
So in my, correct me if I'm wrong, here in Massachusetts, the town of Brookline banned gas. And then there was already a state law, which was not sort of nefarious, I think, but with just a pre-existing law that the whole question got bounced up to the Attorney General's office, right? So here in Massachusetts, it is a state level question based on a law that predated all of this current stuff. Is that accurate? Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, I think Massachusetts is a really interesting case because of Brookline. Brookline tried to ban gas hookups in new buildings, and that was overturned by the Attorney General. And so I think I'll be curious to see what happens with electrification in Massachusetts. And right now we're supporting the 100% Clean Act, which calls for getting rid of combusting fossil fuels in new buildings. I can't remember the exact timeline for that. But I think that's a sliver of hope that's on the horizon in Massachusetts. But yeah, I think we've already seen this effort sort of fail on the local state lines in Massachusetts.
But I mean, across the country, I mean, do you think there's a possibility it's a double-edged sword in the sense that if you can forbid something at the state level, you could also mandate it at the state level.
Yes.
Right? If there was a reversal in the political fortunes of climate hawks in places like, I guess, Oklahoma, just to pick a state out of the blue, right? One way. I saw somewhere a report that said there was a secret meeting with a set of slides that somehow broke into the open. Do you know this? Do you know more about that than I do? What's the story there?
Yes. So this week, I believe it was this week, an E&E article came out and the reporter covered a set of slides that came out of a consortium meeting of 15 different utility companies. And all the materials are about conspiring on anti-electrification efforts. So right there, we have explicit evidence that gas companies, despite any kind of commitments or what they're saying, are actively trying to prevent the transition to electrifying our buildings. So, you know, it's
scary stuff.
Yeah, it is really scary.
I mean, so this is my own little pet peeve. I saw an article that talked about the local Massachusetts utility. I forget which one,
NSTAR
or whatever, saying that they were going to commit to being net zero or zero greenhouse gas up in their operations by 2050, which is that this wonderful talking point, because it's all very confusing, but I mean, it's like they're going to use a wind turbine to run the computers in the office building while at the same time selling natural gas, which is this heinous thing. So it's kind of this lie. So if you see that stuff, right, this is more not to you, Bryn, but more to everyone listening. It's like you see this very noble thing. We say, oh, yeah, we're going to have our greenhouse gas operations limited by, but they're still selling natural gas. It's this funny parsing. Am I right in that? I mean, are you familiar at all with that kind of statement?
Yeah, and I wonder if you're thinking of Eversource, because the E&E article that I just mentioned talks specifically about Eversource and about their offshore wind commitments and things that they liked sort of put out front to be like, hey, look, we're doing things on clean energy. And then behind the scenes, they are conspiring with other utility companies to really prevent that, the transition, and prevent us from getting to a place of actually repowering with clean energy. So it's really quite nefarious.
Right. It's kind of the moral equivalent of those ads you see from Mobil Exxon where they're showing the green algae and how they're going to make energy with it. Right? It's like, yeah, okay, sure.
Yes, exactly.
I believe you. Well, so climate hawks, wherever they are, should be aware of this issue and should be scanning the horizon for are they called anti-gas bills? I mean, is there some sort of way that people can recognize this is in their home state?
So this is a contentious point because these bills are intentionally vague. Unfortunately, they're not called anti-electrification bills, even though that would be, you know, make it a lot easier for advocates. They're called things like restricting utilities, fossil fuel, like there's a lot of buzzwords in them and they're all called different things. So for example, in Florida, one of the bills is called Express Preemption of Fuel Retailers and Related Transportation Infrastructure. If you're a normal person, you fell asleep while I was saying that. It's nobody's following that bill, which is part of the tactic, right? It's so wonky and so in the weeds that nobody's going to be following things like that. One of the bills in Missouri is called Changes the Provisions Related to Utilities. What does that mean if you're a regular person? Yeah. It means nothing. Yeah. I would say it is difficult to identify these bills in your state. I can list the states where they are currently active and where they have passed.
Does Environment America have a list, chapters or groups in the different states? Would that be a place for people to check out? I presume, are you guys like posting this on the national site or something?
Yes. So we do have groups that are advocating against these bills. Unfortunately, a lot of the bills are in states where we don't have a chapter, which has made it harder, you know, to go up against them. We don't have a resource currently on the website. I'm working on getting one up. But what I can do is I can send you a list if you want to include it in the episode description with links to all the bills.
That's super, super, super. Well, dear audience, that's the thing to lie awake at night worrying about. You shouldn't, don't lie awake at night worrying about the stuff in the attic that you have to throw out someday. Worry about this other bill. This is important. Well, so what we'll do is, if you send me that link, Bryn, we'll put it up on the website along with links to the Environment America. What's the website for Environment America?
Yes, so you can find us at environmentamerica.org.
Super. So all one word, Environment America.
Yes.
Super, super, super. So we'll put those up in the blog that's associated with this post. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. So that's where you can go to get the links that we just referred to. If you have a question about the Climate Minute, you want to suggest new topics, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know the good, the bad, and the ugly. If you're listening to the show directly on your smartphone using any of the modern podcast distribution apps, please recommend this to all of your friends because that's your Climate Action for the week. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Brent, thank you so much for being here and giving us the scoop on what's going on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ted. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.